Welcome back to the Vermont Conversation. I'm David Goodman. We're spending the hour with former career diplomat Lizzie Shackelford, who worked in the U.S. State Department until December 2017, when she resigned in protest of the Trump administration. During her time with the Foreign Service, Shackelford served in the U.S. embassies in Poland, South Sudan, Somalia, and Washington, D.C., and she won the State Department's highest honor for her consular work. Her letter of resignation was published in Foreign Policy magazine, and she has subsequently written op-ed pieces sharply critical of the Trump administration and of what has happened to U.S. foreign policy since. Lizzie, let's move to when you resigned from the State Department. When did you decide you just couldn't take it anymore?
Yeah, I get this question often. You know, what was the kind of what was the breaking point? But it really built up over a long time. It was, you know, there were big things. There was, you know, the attempt to strip the budget. There was the Muslim travel ban. But it was really more kind of the everyday issues. You know, one I mentioned before, just the fact that in meetings and in our bilateral and multilateral relations overseas, we had a lot less influence. You know, it was the fact that people were leaving posts and not, you know, leadership positions and not getting replaced. My last several months with the State Department, we did not have an ambassador at all for Somalia, and that had a big impact on our ability to be effective. It was the kind of continued opening up of military influence in places like Somalia, where while our kind of State Department and civilian leadership was receding. And it just built up over time. I got to the point where I was asking myself every day, you know, why am I staying? I'm staying because I think we could do more good on the inside. And then, you know, one day it became clear that I wasn't able to. My worry was that, you know, with less civilian leadership and kind of more leeway for our military activity in Somalia, that we would get to a position where something very dangerous could happen. And I didn't want to be complicit in that type of activity. So I resigned I decided probably about 2 months before I left, and then had decided that I wanted to share my resignation letter. So being a good little bureaucrat that I am, read the regulations to make sure that I could secure the right permissions for sharing my resignation letter publicly. And that took a little bit of time too. But once I left, I really haven't looked back, and particularly looking at what's been happening over the past few weeks with, you know, a lot of folks in the State Department finally coming forward to Congress, I do not have any regrets about leaving when I did.
You've been described in many accounts as a rising star in the State Department. What was the aftermath? What was the fallout from your resignation, in which you did not pull any punches criticizing Tillerson, the Secretary of State, and the Trump administration? Tell us what happened when your bomb dropped.
Surprisingly, it was mostly a very positive reaction from colleagues and former colleagues, people who were really pleased to see someone saying publicly what so many other people in the State Department had wanted to say. I think I benefited from the fact that I resigned so kind of at the early side, before people were really publicly taking a stand and resigning. And it, for that reason, you know, I really didn't get any real reaction officially from the State Department. Everything that I got was unofficial from people who were, you know, proud of what I was saying kind of on the State Department, on the behalf of other Foreign Service officers. I know people who have left since, and kind of in the months after I did, who have been harassed somewhat by in the State Department for speaking out by certain folks inside. So I think that it has gotten harder as more and more people did, and as that's starting to have an impact on, you know, the credibility of what the department is doing. But by and large, I was really pleased.
You're now seeing your former colleagues in the Foreign Service in an extraordinary moment, I would have to say, in the history of diplomacy in the United States, where we are seeing career Foreign Service officers go up against the White House in defiance of White House orders and tell Congress what they know about political interference in U.S. foreign policy. What's it like for you right now, seeing a lot of your former colleagues take this stand? It has been described as the revolt of the diplomats.
Yeah, it's really great to finally see, you know, people who have direct knowledge of a lot of the, certainly dangerous from a national security perspective activity going on, and even including some criminal activity. So it's great to see people coming forward who are able to reveal what's really going on the inside. I think the biggest question for me is, what more do more diplomats know? I mean, this has to just be the tip of the iceberg, because we're talking about, one situation, one very specific situation with Ukraine and President Trump's political issues there. But what we don't know is how many other incidents like this have happened, and how many dozens of people, whether in the White House or in the State Department or other agencies, know what's going on. What I have to say primarily is that I am extremely grateful for the whistleblower for coming forward before anyone was being subpoenaed, before any of this was public. I'm really risking that person's, career and frankly safety under these circumstances to come forward to reveal that crimes were happening. That frankly is what opened the door for what we're seeing now, because it gave Congress the information they needed to subpoena people. We're seeing a lot of very brave souls out of the State Department who are coming forward to Congress, but we need to remember that, this stuff has been going on for a long time and people have known it for a long time. And the people coming forward now are coming forward with the benefit of public support and subpoenas. And that's something that, the whistleblower, whoever he or she is, and hopefully we will never find out, because that would be dangerous for that person, but being the first one who really opened the door for this, that person is really the hero here. And hopefully, as more and more people come forward to testify and to bring that information, that will just have a knock-on effect to people who know about, other dangerous situations and other crimes. And I expect this is only the beginning.
Were you shocked, and have you been shocked in recent weeks, just hearing about what has gone on in Ukraine, where you have what is described as a shadow foreign policy and shadow operators completely undermining the normal channels of U.S. foreign policy and having it run by Trump's private attorney, Rudy Giuliani, and others who he dispatches?
Sadly, nothing out of this administration shocks me. And if you watch what they've been doing gradually, they've been replacing almost all of the leadership with political appointees. You have a much higher number of political leadership roles in the State Department than we've ever had before. You have the National Security Council has largely been gutted with almost exclusively political appointees in it. And when you don't have career people in most of these leadership positions, it becomes a lot easier to do whatever, Donald Trump wants to do in his own personal benefit. I'm also not that shocked that it was kind of allowed to go on, because the culture at the State Department is Foreign Service officers are in a lot of ways, kind of soldiers in their own right. And they forge ahead and they largely do what they're told. There's not a strong dissent culture within the State Department. So I'm not surprised that it was allowed to happen for so long. At the same time, I'm not surprised that at this stage it's coming out, because I think people have on the inside have been very alarmed, and they were just waiting for what seemed like the best moment to come forward. But we've seen a complete collapse of checks and balances in this government, and checks and balances are there for a reason. We can't trust individual humans to be good and do the best thing for this country, and that's why we have checks on every branch. But the major challenge that we've seen here is that we've had a complicit Senate leadership. If Congress isn't able to come forward to check a rogue and criminal president, we're pretty much doomed. So hopefully you know, the House is doing what they need to, the Democrats are doing what they need to, and hopefully more and more we will see, you know, the kind of Republican-controlled Senate step up as well, because that's what we need in order to have a check. I'm not surprised at the horrible criminal things that humans do. I think the only thing that surprises me at this stage is that fewer people along the way have been willing to play checks on that type of behavior.
So the American president is now, impeachment proceedings are underway. What is this like? What do you hear from your former colleagues about what this is like for them right now? And also with the news coming out about this shadow foreign policy in Ukraine, you know, trying to have political hit jobs against political opponents here. I mean, in many ways, it's making the U.S. resemble a lot more like the corrupt countries that we're trying to coax developing countries not to be.
That's exactly what it is like. You know, two thoughts here. One is, it's been very hard for a long time for my former colleagues to do their jobs overseas, because it's quite difficult to say you should try and harness corruption and in your country and promote human rights and, you know, create a more you know, stable and clean, you know, economic and security situation when we're not doing any of that in our own country right now. But I think the overriding sense that I get from my former colleagues who are still in the State Department now is one of optimism and pride at seeing a lot of their leaders coming forward and being able to provide the information that's needed to bring a check on this president. You know, people are they're feeling vindicated that, you know, even though it has taken a long time for a lot of this to come out, State Department officers are, you know, meticulous in their note taking, and, you know, we understand what matters at different stages and in some of these political and criminal cases. And you see someone like Bill Taylor, who's, you know, brought forward meticulous information about what was going on at the time. And that's the type of thing that's really going to help Congress make the right decisions here. So I think that people are feeling, you know, a bit revitalized, and hopefully that there is hope for the future that we're going to get back to a better place with our foreign policy. My long-term hope is that there will be a greater appreciation on the other side of this administration for the role and the importance of our civilian leadership in the diplomatic front and for career leadership by experts and people who understand the countries and the places in which we work.
You're listening to Vermont Conversation. We're talking with Lizzie Shackelford, a career diplomat from the State Department who resigned in December 2017 in protest of the Trump administration. What do you it's interesting to hear your optimism, but you've also described that the State Department and the Foreign Service where you worked are now a shadow of their former selves. There have been widespread vacancies. How long will it take to rebuild the U.S. Foreign Service?
It could take a very long time, certainly, but it depends on, first of all, how quickly we start to right the ship. You know, if 2020 we're able to get a different administration in that really does, you know, double down on the need to rebuild our Foreign Service, I think that there are a lot of things that you can do to rebuild it fairly quickly. I think there are tactics that we have avoided in the past, such as bringing people in mid-level. I mean, the Foreign Service, it doesn't matter where you are in your career. When you start at the Foreign Service, you start fairly low and you work your way up. I think that to rebuild the Foreign Service, they might need to be a little bit creative with attracting people who've left to come back in, with bringing people in at the, you know, kind of mid-level people with management experience and that type of thing. So there are creative ways that we can try and rebuild it. Now, if we end up with another 4 years of gutting the Foreign Service, I think that you've got a generation at least before you're able to build it back up. And that's once you start rebuilding. You know, it can have a very long-term impact. If you think about the investment that this, you know, the taxpayers have put into the Foreign Service, I mean, I spent a grand total of about 13 or 14 months being taught full-time languages while I was at the State Department, being taught Polish before my first tour and taught Somali before my last tour. That's an investment. That's a financial investment. That's something that you can't just, pick back up overnight. I was a regional expert in different parts of the African continent. You know, you're losing a lot of people now who have expertise and knowledge and language skills for places like China and Russia. You just can't, kind of recreate that overnight, not to mention the kind of skills of diplomacy. So I think the sooner that we get back to that, the better. But it's going to take some work for sure.
So you're living now in Rochester, Vermont. What brought you here and what are you doing now?
My partner and I are, I would say, kind of political and climate refugees. We came to Vermont because we both love rural areas. I was raised in Mississippi. He's from Alabama, but he did spend a number of years in his youth up in Lamoille County. So he's always loved Vermont. And we came back here because we wanted to be around kind of like-minded people who appreciate the outdoors and local living and local economies, and how active people are in kind of a civic participation at every level in Vermont. So we want to be somewhere, as climate change continues to march along, somewhere that appreciates preservation and conservation, and also has more pleasant climate than my home state of Mississippi these days. But it's the culture here, and we really chose it because we wanted to be in a place that has this type of kind of progressive local culture.
So, where are you investing your political energies these days?
Well, I'm doing as much as I can to share the importance of rebuilding a civilian-led foreign policy. I'm doing a lot of writing on that area these days. I actually have a book that's going to be published in May on parts of my experience in the Foreign Service and beliefs on where we should be going next. I'm also getting involved at a local level in a way that I haven't been able to my entire adult life, as I've been moving around and living primarily overseas. So, I go to my select board meetings. We've restarted the local chapter of the Democratic Party here in Rochester, and we're knocking doors ahead of the presidential primary next door in New Hampshire. We're just getting involved at every level, and it's exciting because it's something that, as a U.S. diplomat, I was not able to get overtly involved in politics. And I realized with the election of Donald Trump, one of my regrets was that I had not been back here participating in our democracy, because it is not a spectator sport. And while I did believe strongly that what I was doing was important work for our country and the world, I regretted that I hadn't been knocking doors and getting out the vote ahead of the 2016 election. So my plan between now and next year, and then moving forward, is just to be as active as I can be of a citizen in our democracy.
You have a candidate who you like most at this point in the presidential race?
I do. I'm a big fan of Elizabeth Warren. She put out a very good plan over the summer on how to rebuild State Department and our civilian leadership and foreign policy. I do believe, in coming from Mississippi, I've seen it very, very closely that the level of inequality in this country really needs to be addressed. And, I think that we need to do some bold things to do it. But I tell you, the day after the primaries, whoever wins, I will be out knocking doors for with great enthusiasm, because, the number one goal right now is to get an administration that, can give us our leadership position, both here at home and overseas. It's we've never had a more critical election. And I plan to do whatever I can in my role here to help bring change, the change that we need.
Would you consider going back into the Foreign Service under a new administration?
I have not decided that. I think that there are a lot of ways that, one thing that I've learned being on the outside is that there are a lot of ways to have a voice and have influence on what we're doing. So I do expect that I will stay involved in foreign policy. It is you know, something that I think is both extremely important and very interesting to me. But I'm not sure if I'd be willing to go back into the administration world. Plus, you know, I live in Vermont. It's wonderful. Why would I want to move?
Do you find that any of your skills working in the villages of Africa or other places you've been are particularly useful in the villages of Vermont?
I do. I think one of the things that I've learned is that, you know, people around the world are all a lot more similar than we are different. We're concerned about things that affect our day-to-day lives. We want to take care of the environments in which we live. We want to take care of the people who are important to us. And frankly, at any local level, it's kind of hard to organize people and keep a meeting going. You'd be surprised. I feel sometimes in local meetings here in Rochester that it's as hard to get people on point as it was in Mogadishu. So people are really pretty similar around the world. And all politics at the end of the day is local. So that is probably my biggest takeaway from trying to bring some of those skills and experiences overseas back here.
Okay. Well, Lizzie Shackelford, I want to thank you for joining us on the Vermont Conversation this week.
Thank you for having me.
Lizzie Shackelford was a career diplomat in the U.S. State Department until December 2017, when she resigned in protest of the Trump administration. That does it for this week's Vermont Conversation. You can hear this and all shows at vermontconversation.com. And tune in next Wednesday at 1 for another Vermont Conversation. I'm David Goodman. Thanks so much for listening.